Today's symposium prelude is one of this year's Paul E. Olson Seminars in Great Plains Studies. Our speaker is Bruce Garver, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and co-chair for the symposium. Dr. Garver completed his PhD in history at Yale in 1971 and taught there full-time until coming to UNO in 1976. On 11 occasions since 1967, he has studied, researched, and taught in Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic. Bruce has written extensively on Czech history. Professor Garver served as chair of the UNO History Department for 16 years and is a member of 8 professional associations and a fellow of the center. He was inspired by many of his professors and colleagues to devote so much of his life to the study of Czech and Slovak history. Although having no known Slavic ancestors, Bruce has been a longtime member of the Czech Cultural Club of Omaha and served as its president. I first became acquainted with Bruce while serving with him on the committee for this symposium and was quite overwhelmed by the Czech knowledge and speech demonstrated by a man of Finnish and German background. Dr. Garver's presentation today is complemented by a two-part article in the March and April editions of Prairie Fire. Help me welcome Bruce as he discusses immigration to the Great Plains, 1985 to 1914, war, politics, technology, and economic development.
Well, thank you, Bob, for the introduction. I would like to add my invitation to yours, to the audience, and to anyone whom they may know to attend our symposium on Czech and Slovak Americans, International Perspectives from the Great Plains, that will take place here at UNL from the evening of April 7th through April 9th. And that is well advertised on cards that you see here and also in the Prairie Fire, my article in the Prairie Fire magazine that Bob mentioned to all of you. Topic I'm going to talk about today is Czech immigration to the Great Plains, 1865 to 1914, war, politics, technology, and economic development. As I think back on it, this is for someone my age, this is a very short time, 39 years, in which the Great Plains of North America were transformed into prosperous American states and Canadian prairie provinces. In slightly more than a generation, what had been a largely arid wilderness, grassland wilderness, was by 1914 an area of a number of prosperous large cities, many towns, many small towns, and a thriving commercial agriculture. And the states of the Great Plains were tied to the United States by perhaps the best railway network of the world. And my talk will emphasize the extent to which European immigrants, their brains, their labor, were very much a part of this process, along with Americans who were born in other parts of the United States. It's extraordinary as we look back on it how much was achieved in a very short time. To illustrate the importance of education and technology in this rapid development, I have several slides from Hospodář, the farmer. At one time, the largest in circulation agricultural weekly magazine in the world, and then for a long time, the largest in the Americas. It was published here in Omaha, or I should say up the road in Omaha. The old publishing plant, the Národní tiskárna, is still there at the southwest corner of 12th and Harney Streets, if you ever in the old market area, you might want to stop and take a look at it. But I use this to illustrate the fact that Czech immigrants, German immigrants, in fact, most immigrants who came to the United States in the last third of the 19th century, came from Europe with a good basic primary education and considerable skills in agriculture or manufacturing or whatever they had done for a living in Europe. This made them readily employable, even without a knowledge of English, and the fact that they were already used to modern technology, as well as had a basic education, enabled them to fit in rather quickly in the highly industrialized American economy of the late 19th century. This cover of the Hospodars celebrates the Wawerka brothers, two Czech farmers and inventors who in 1827 produced a improved wheeled plow that was widely employed in agriculture. What we're looking at here is nearly 90 years of agricultural progress celebrated. The original Wawerka wheeled plow, the Wawerka brothers themselves, this is taken from a lithograph of the great monument in Pardubice in eastern Bohemia, celebrating these famous sons of that city. And finally, a plowing the fields with modern technology, 1916. Up above is a portrait of the old way of harvesting. Not very efficient, but a task that required the hard work of every member of the family capable of working at the time of harvest. Interestingly enough, we in a technologically advanced state celebrate the old way of sowing grain with our sower atop the Capitol. I never quite figured that one out, but and also in the Hospodars is another lithograph of modern farming methods with a steam tractor and harvesters following it, pulling the machines to cut the wheat as of 1916. So there was a keen interest on the part of all immigrants in, they knew something about technology when they came and they learned more about it when they were here, and they adapted fairly quickly to American markets, American technology, and also the American political system. Second observation, but before I'd ask, I'd request Kim's assistance. We can shut down the, turn up the lights and shut off the PowerPoint now that I've shown you some illustrations. By the way, we have the complete set of Hospodars in print in the Czech Heritage Collection at Love Library. If you haven't been there, it's one of the finest collections of materials on Czechs and Slovaks in North America to be found anywhere in the world. Only the Library of Congress, Immigration Archives in Minnesota, and several of the larger Ivy League and Big Ten libraries have anything comparable to it. It's a testimony to the knowledge and determination of the first archivist of the University of Nebraska, Joseph Svoboda, himself a refugee from communism, who fled Czechoslovakia as a teenager, high school teenager, to come to first to Italy, then to Canada and the United States. It's a great treasure we have here in Nebraska, and I encourage those of you who haven't seen it to stop by the third floor of Love Library and ask perhaps to take a look at several of the fine publications. I am often asked why I chose to spend a large part of my life studying Czech, Slovak, Polish history, when, to the best of my knowledge, I have no ancestors from that part of the world. At the University of, it's very easily answered, at the University of Colorado, I was a student of S. Harrison Thompson, who had founded the Journal of Central European Affairs in 1940 after the Nazis closed the Revue d'Etudes Slaves in Paris. and was himself the author of two Latin editions of important works of John Huss, and a book published by Princeton University Press, Czechoslovakian European History, that went through two important editions. I was a French major at Colorado, and my sophomore advanced composition French teacher asked me if I had taken a course from Professor Thompson, and I said, no, I hadn't. She said, well, he's the best professor at the university, and you really should do that. So, impressionable youth that I was, I signed up for the next fall and met Professor Thompson, whose first question to all students, I later discovered, was the one he gave to me: how many foreign languages can you speak? Well, I was pretty pleased with myself. I told him in French I was a French major, and he said, He said, anybody who knows 40 words of French can read it, which is... He delighted in brilliant half-truths. I discovered this later on, too. He said, have you studied German? And I said, no, I hadn't. I didn't add that it hadn't occurred to me that I should, but I was smart enough not to do that. And he said, well, if you've been here 2 years already and you haven't studied German, he said, you're probably wasting either your money or your parents' money. I suggest if you're seriously interested in history, you go out and sign up for German. He said, another brilliant half-truth, the Germans have written more history than anybody else. Now, that's not true either, but they've written a lot. And then he said, most of what they've written is pretty wrong-headed, but you have to know it anyway. So I went out, I signed up for German, too. I was ready to go. Dynamic fellow, Thompson. He'd won the medals in the on the decathlon team in the 1920 Olympics. He'd served in the American Expeditionary Force in World War I, fought the Germans again in World War II, although this time as an officer in the OSS. Another clever half-truth that of Thompson's that comes to mind: first day of class. We're 14 years from the end of the Second World War. And he asks, why have the Germans been such bad actors in our century? No student wanted to try that one, an answer to that one, on the first day of class. So he couldn't coax the answers out of us. So finally he answered his own question. He said, that's easy. Of course, it's not. It's a very complicated question. He said, that's easy. He said, in the 19th century, all the decent Germans moved to the United States. So that'll introduce the German immigrants. I'm going to say a few words about German immigrants today as well. But as a child, I was thinking back when I first became interested in, I'd have to say Slavs, because Czechs didn't much cross my mind until I got to college, but I grew up around a fair number of people who have Ukrainian and Polish ancestry. And Stan Musial was one of the best baseball players going in my youth, along with Ted Kluszewski, who played first base in Cincinnati, so I had a pretty high opinion of Poles based on what I'd observed on the baseball field. And that translated into an interest, I think, later in Slavs generally. As for Italians, I remember going with my parents and my sister as a child to the unveiling of the monument, the great monument to Christopher Columbus, in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. Sono nato nella più grande città del mondo, nominato dopo il gran navigatore italiano Cristoforo Colombo. So I suppose it came naturally to me to get interested in Italian history, in immigration history, because I was born, as I just said, an Italian in the largest city in the world named after the greatest Italian navigator. So the citizens of Genoa, Columbus's birthplace, had given this to the citizens of Columbus, and there was a great celebration. Bands and Italian anthems and speech from a mayor of Genoa. It was quite the occasion. Then we lived not far from Grandview Heights, Ohio, and the Pennsylvania Railroad industrial suburb of Santa Margherita, which was heavily Italian. And in Columbus, as out here on the Great Plains, many of the first Italian workers who came were railway workers. And also, at the time, I played football for Worthington High School, a middling-sized town in central Ohio. The best, most famous football player who had come out of our league 5 or 6 years earlier was Ralph Guglielmi. I don't know if any of you remember Ralph Guglielmi. He went on from Grandview Heights to quarterback at Notre Dame and then for the Los Angeles Rams. Well, his mom and dad, capitalizing on their son's deservedly famous name for athletic abilities, brought out in Columbus a line of Ma Guglielmi's spaghetti sauce, which was pretty good. But we football players at Worthington High School, before every game, this was through high school, we would rub a little bit of Ma Guglielmi's tomato sauce behind our ears to presumably improve our performance in the coming football games. Well, through all that, we never had a losing season. So I don't know whether to attribute to some of the great Ralph Guglielmi's talent being rubbed off on us or not. But so I had an interesting introduction to Italian immigration. And from my own family background, there were members of my grandparents' generation who spoke German. And I knew a German Methodist church in the industrial city of Hamilton, Ohio, where many members of my mother's family were still members and where my mother and her sister had been raised. This was an interesting one of the many religious denominations that Germans founded or joined here in the United States. There is, given the sheer size of the number of Americans of German ancestry, you would expect to find the immigration history to be very complicated, as indeed it is, since Germany itself had 302 independent principalities, ecclesiastical or secular, as late as the time of the French Revolution, 1789, and had 32 independent principalities as late as 1866. So the Germans divided in Europe politically and religiously more than any other group. Their presence in the United States reflected this enormous diversity. I'm going to, just to give you an example of what we use in immigration history, I'm going to send around a few books. This is a memorial book of the West German Conference of the German Methodist Church in the United States right after the turn of the century. And pictures the churches, many of the leaders of the church, lay leaders and ministers. Comparable book for Czechs. There's some pictures of Nebraska in here. Is one of several books by Vojta Beneš, brother of the man who would become the first foreign minister and the second president of independent Czechoslovakia, who came to the United States before World War I, and then again after the war started to coordinate fundraising here in the United States to support the struggle for Czechoslovak independence against Germany and Austria-Hungary in the First World War. So I'll start that one over here. And finally, Italian immigration. Those of you like movie stars, there's nice, some of the pictures are of Italian-American movie stars, starting with Rudolph Valentino. This is the first of a three-volume series that Italian scholars have recently published in Italy about Italian immigration to the United States. Okay, the advent and extent of mass immigration to the Great Plains states is perhaps best understood in the new international context that emerged in the 1860s out of five large wars. The Crimean War, the defeat of Austria by France in Piedmont in 1859, the American Civil War, the insurrection of the Mexicans to drive out the French army out of Mexico between 1862 and 1867, and the Seven Weeks' War in Europe of 1866. whose consequences included, in their aftermath, enlarged civil liberties, accelerated economic, technological, and agricultural innovation, expanded world markets, and increased immigration to the United States from East Central and Southern Europe. I'm going to stress the importance of these wars and the political reforms that they produced, because so long as serfdom obtained, as it did in the Austrian Empire until September 1848, or in Russia until March 1861, immigration on any large scale couldn't take place. A comparable period where you had a reactionary political force in charge that curtailed immigration occurred between 1945 and 1990, where the communist regimes were, with their western borders were mined and marked by barbed wire and armed border police to keep people from departing. So you not only had to have the attraction here in the United States to bring immigrants, you had to have the immigrants' ability to leave the countries where they lived. And that comes certainly with these wars of the mid-19th century. Or you can't imagine the Great Plains being settled as quickly and as rapidly as they were without the United States having defeated the Confederacy in the Civil War. Because the Confederacy was a great impediment with slavery to the expansion of free labor and industry. And then because the Great Plains area before 1866 was sparsely populated and is inhospitable to pre-industrial agricultural and transport, its emergence within one generation as a region of prosperous cities, towns, and commercial agriculture linked by railways cannot be comprehended without reference to all of the developments I just mentioned. And to illustrate how this transformation took place, I'm going to emphasize the experience of three immigrant groups, Czechs, Italians, and Germans. On the grounds, they're the groups I know the best, and they're the groups whose history in Europe I know the best, and also I think because together they represent most of the skills and abilities and interests of the rest of the European immigrants, and I'll follow that up in a few minutes. Let me just say a word briefly about the four large wars from 1854 to 1867, or five large wars. The defeat of Imperial Russia by France, Britain, and Piedmont, Sardinia in the Crimean War of 1854 to 56 had persuaded Tsar Alexander II and his advisors to emancipate all serfs on March 3, 1861 as the first step toward limited political and economic reforms that would lay the groundwork for industrialization and increased emigration by the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. The defeat of the Austrian Empire by France and Piedmont Sardinia in the summer of 1859 opened the way for a creation of a united and liberal Italian monarchy and persuaded the Habsburgs to transform the Austrian Empire into a constitutional monarchy whose representative political bodies removed obstacles to emigration and encouraged industrialization and state-supported elementary education. Prussia's and Italy's defeat of the Austrian Empire and its smaller German allies in the Seven Weeks' War of 1866 enabled Italy to annex the Veneto, that's that vast area around Venice, including Vicenza and Verona, and obliged the Habsburgs in 1867 to grant internal independence to the Hungarians in a reconstituted dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary. The unification of Italy, whose principal architects were Count Camillo Benso di Cavour and Giuseppe Garibaldi, had required the military defeat of the Austrian Empire and also the Kingdom of Naples and the Papal State in order to bring almost all Italians under the rule of Piedmontese law and institutions, and to inaugurate not only the creation of a national railway network, postal system, and armed forces, but also of bona fica, the reclamation of agriculture of marginal lands, particularly in the draining of swamps, and also the beginning of the conquest of malaria, heretofore the principal scourge of the Italian people. So you're getting these building of railway and steamship lines on both sides of the Atlantic. And it obviously, you're all familiar with the importance of the rail network in creating an industrial United States, in a greater sense, and a national economy here in the United States. But you have much the same thing going on in Europe. So it's you buy the ticket from Prague, for example, to Omaha on the rail lines of Austria-Hungary, of Prussia, from steamship passage from the port of Hamburg to New York, then let's say the Pennsylvania Railroad to Chicago and the Union Pacific to Omaha. You've got everything on one ticket. It's fast, it's safe, and it's far less expensive than transportation used to be. So this, I am urging, I think, as a European historian, historian of Europe, urging Americans to pay a lot more attention to what goes on in Europe. At the same time, similar events occur in the United States. And understanding immigration and the growth of this part of the country, I think we need to look very carefully on both sides of the Atlantic. Union victory in the American Civil War has long been recognized as essential to making Texas and Kansas into free states and enabling the Great Plains territories to become states characterized by representative government, free labor, corporate enterprise, and mass immigration from continental Europe as well as other parts of North America. In defeating the Confederacy, the United States abolished the economically inefficient and morally repugnant institution of slavery in the most destructive war ever fought in the Western Hemisphere. In fighting bravely to the bitter end to preserve this ugly institution, the Confederates hastened its eradication and their belated post-war discovery of more profitable and challenging ways to earn a living than by cruelly exploiting human chattel. Less often acknowledged by American historians is the extent to which the political reforms flowing from the wars of mid-19th century Europe that I've already reviewed, similarly, albeit to a lesser extent, facilitated the settlement of the Great Plains states and the growth of a prosperous American economy. Unlike the slave-owning founders of the Confederacy, the European defenders of aristocratic privilege and authoritarian monarchical government at mid-19th century chose not to fight on until their way of life and their armies were utterly destroyed, but instead gave way quickly to make peace with constitutional monarchical governments led by liberals and nationalists who thereafter established the rule of law, encouraged industrialization, and authorized, although they seldom encouraged, the emigration of newly emancipated citizens. Both accelerated industrialization and the movements of restrictions on immigration enabled millions of Poles and Italians and hundreds of thousands of Czechs, Slovaks, Ukrainians, Croats, and Hungarians, among others, to leave their homes to seek greater economic opportunities elsewhere, principally in the United States, but also in the comparably industrializing areas of France, Germany, Lower Austria, and Bohemia, and northern Italy, and in the newly opened agricultural lands and growing cities of Argentina and Brazil and Canada. The process of peasant emancipation had begun earlier in the 19th century, as I mentioned, with the emancipation of the Prussian serfs after Napoleon blew away the Prussian army in two battles on a single afternoon in October 1806, and then in the Austrian Empire after the outbreak of the revolutions throughout that empire in March 1848. And I've mentioned the Russian abolition of serfdom in 1861 already. From 1871 to 1914, world markets swiftly developed in an era of constitutional representative government, rapid industrialization, and unprecedented peace and prosperity in Europe and North America from 1871 to 1914. Only in the period 1945 to the present have we had a longer period in European history of peace, economic prosperity, and stability. This was an era in which Europe became the world's banker. One had 4 decades of economic growth, rising profit and wages, temporarily interrupted by depressions in the early 1870s, the late 1880s, early 1890s, and in 1907. The opening of the Great Plains to commercial agriculture and inexpensive railway transport accelerated at least 3 more developments with international repercussions. The first was a worsening agricultural depression in Europe, where farmers, despite protective tariffs, proved less and less capable of producing and transporting grain to domestic markets at prices competitive with American, Canadian, or Argentinian grain planted and harvested by machinery and transported by rail and steamships to European markets. The consequent onset of agricultural depression in Europe in the late 1880s further stimulated European emigration to the Americas from such agriculturally overpopulated European regions as Ireland, southern Italy, Galicia, southern and southeastern Bohemia, southwestern Norway, and northern Hungary, the present-day Slovakia. Secondly, our European immigrants in the upper Middle West and Great Plains adjusted, as did American farmers and small businessmen, to rapidly changing economic and social conditions, even though many of these immigrants had initially intended to perpetuate desirable features of traditional European rural life and religion in their New World homes. Finally, a similar, though less extensive, agricultural crisis occurred in the United States as farmers in New England and upstate New York found it increasingly difficult to compete in urban northeastern markets with grain carried by rail from the mechanized farms of the Middle West and the Great Plains. Consequently, as all of you, I think, learned in basic American history courses, these northeastern American farmers began to organize the Grange, long named the patrons of husbandry, and to agitate for governmental regulation of railroad rates to prevent what they perceived to be discrimination in favor of the long haul as opposed to the short haul. A difference in rates that the railroads claimed was both desirable and fair given the identical costs of loading and unloading freight cars, regardless of how far such cars had traveled. I make the observation in what is a longer paper than I'm going to read that the Great Plains are not markedly different from other steppe regions of the world. And what characterizes this part of the world and what I've emphasized in the talk from other parts of the world is not the physical environment, but the presence here after 1865 of free institutions, the rule of law, and a mass immigration coming in from Great Britain and continental Europe, as well as Canada and parts of Mexico. Historians of this period, I might add, as all of you I'm sure know, we also take a look at fiction, we take a look at art, we seek as much information as we can from different academic disciplines in the humanities and the social sciences. Fiction, as you all know, creates as well as emphasizes individual characters, including those afflicted by troubles of their own making, as well as those whose lives have been shattered by powerful economic crises or political events. And doing so, fiction often provides a desirable anecdote, an alternative perspective to what Europeans frequently perceive as American triumphalism in the writing of our history, and notions of exceptionalism, at least to the extent obliging historians, fiction would oblige historians to evaluate more critically those institutions whose policies and developments affect the lives of ordinary people. And I won't run down the list of famous Nebraska authors that you all know who have written about such people and looked critically at some of the institutions and policies of this country as they have affected characters in their novels in this period. On the other hand, you perhaps have too much emphasis on fiction and film, at least if you're using them as the primary means of trying to understand history, important though they are in this respect. This sometimes leads historians, I think, to underestimate the positive influence of family, community, schools, and churches, or other means of ethical education and developing trust in the formation of every individual's knowledge, character, and other qualities that facilitate, likely to facilitate success in life. We also have, perhaps this comes later in life, but a pervasive American propensity to make generous bequests to universities and churches and other institutions promoting the common weal. That reflects certainly American recognition of personal indebtedness and gratitude to such institutions. So I do want to say a few words about schools and churches and their part in building up the life and economy of our states here in the Great Plains. We do see in the memoirs of Czech or German or even Italian immigrants some celebration of rugged individualism. If we take the many biographies, short biographies sent in, I'm just going to use the Czechs as an example here, representative of other groups, to the Hospodaj and other magazines by Czech immigrants, usually writing when they're in their 60s or 70s or 80s, about their experiences in the new country. And most of them in these counts, these are mostly farmers, small businessmen, reported their greatest adventure to have been achieving professional or business success or having wrested from farmland a livelihood for themselves and their families. We have these all of these magazines that carried these, like American and Narod, which were a free-thinking and a Catholic almanac, respectively, and then the Hospodaj, the farmer whose cover page I showed you from 1916. These memoirs are comparable in many respects to those published in English-language newspapers or in local county and state history books sold by subscriptions. Books which included individual biographies and histories of particular businesses, churches, and civic organizations. Usually for a fee, your biography could be included or your organization's history could be included in such volumes. With regard to the Czech, I think noteworthy were the publications of the historian, banker, and publicist Tomáš Čapek, 1861 to 1950, including his Moja Amerika, Vzpomínky a Úvahy, and the entrepreneur, industrialist, and founder of the Volcek Tool Company in Cleveland, Ohio, František J. Volcek, in his Povídka mého života, which has been translated by my colleague Winston Krizlock at St. Thomas College in St. Paul as a memoir of my life. Another important observation about these memoirs, as in those of German, Italian, and other immigrants, one finds no discernible reflection of differences among immigrant groups that in any way corresponds to the regions of the United States in which these groups happen to reside. Such differences that did arise among immigrant groups appear to correspond instead to some of the regions of the old country from which these groups had departed or the religious denomination in which the immigrants had been raised. I really looked through a lot of literature to try to find something that sets Czech immigrants or German immigrants or Italian immigrants in this part of the country apart from the same immigrants in any other part of the country, and I can't find it. The immigrants are divided by Italians, they certainly are Catholics, but Germans by religion, Czechs by religion, and also by free thinking, which roughly half of all Czech immigrants who came to this country did not join organized religion as a matter of principle. and I've written about that in the Prairie Fire and in other places, so I won't talk about it here, though I will answer questions if anybody has them. This reminded me, I had another, this is a Xerox copy, but it's Ilupo. This is Omaha, Italian newspaper. Why do you suppose the Italians are calling it Ilupo, the wolf? What are they reminding people of? Not Mussolini's Wolves of Fascism, which was a pretty ugly organization, but Romulus and Remus, of course. The Italians are an ancient people, a very ancient people. When my ancestors, Finns, French, Germans, English, Irish, were cavorting about in furs in the forests or caves of northern Europe, the Italians had a wonderful civilization. I mean, this, and then on the back is a nice ad for the. This is in 19 October 1925. A nice ad for the Fratelli Rizzuto, the Rizzuto brothers, who are railway contractors, and most of the Italian immigrants who came to the Great Plains. Ended up out here working on railways or in food processing or in unskilled jobs. The newly united Italy did great wonders, as I mentioned, with railways and telegraph service and an army, but they didn't do as well as Czech-speaking or German-speaking Europe or Scandinavian Europe or belatedly even France in developing public schools. So the Italian, Slovak, Polish, typical Italian, Slovak, Polish, Ukrainian immigrant came here just as smart, just as industrious, probably, though their educational horizons were somewhat limited, nearly as ambitious as the better educated immigrants from other parts of Europe. So it takes these later groups, given the same basic human abilities, maybe an extra generation to catch up and succeed, which they've done. So, Ilupo, I'll start Ilupo. Prevalent from the very beginning of the settlement of the Great Plains was the mutually beneficial partnership between government, corporate enterprise, and small businesses, be they agricultural or mercantile, whose positive contributions to later 19th and early 20th century population growth, economic prosperity, and political stability are unintelligible without reference to one another. Well understood and appreciated by American historians has been the success of the federal government in deploying armies to drive Indians onto reservations, in undertaking scientific exploration. I see Gary Moulton is back there with Lewis and Clark, one of the first and best of these, and in subsidizing both the construction of transport infrastructure and the distribution of inexpensive land through the Homestead Act of 1862 or by other means. On the other hand, historians have occasionally underestimated, I think, the extent to which governmental institutions, public schools, and technology have continued to contribute to the growth and prosperity of the Great Plains states. In the Great Plains, the majority of the pioneering settlers who came here arrived as ambitious, intelligent, and formally educated young adults who were also often married and usually in the best of health and approaching the prime of life. Settlers introduced the free governmental institutions that they knew in other parts of the parts of the United States from which they came. And this is, I think, a well-known part of American history. Perhaps less well-known is the fact that Canadian, Mexican, British, of course, and continental European immigrants all brought personal assets besides ambition, self-confidence, and a capacity for hard work. Their character had already been formed before they got here, just as their knowledge had been acquired elsewhere. Consequently, none of the newly established Great Plains states had been obliged to pay for the education or raising of these energetic and intelligent, you might say, ready-made citizens. But, appreciating the value of scientific knowledge and the liberal arts, the citizens of each, this was true of the Middle West, certainly the Great Plains state, were initially generous in providing funds for the establishment of public elementary, secondary, and higher education. So one of the reasons I think this area grows so fast, so quickly, is because you're getting already educated, skilled young people coming out here in large numbers and wanting to pass on to their children the benefits that they had received. In Europe, the better educational systems go back, as some of you may know, to the Prussian school law of 1818, which for the first time in history created a national system of universal, free, compulsory, and state-supported public elementary education. Its immediate success in diminishing illiteracy and in raising the competence of army recruits and industrial workers soon led to its being emulated by monarchical governments in almost all other German-speaking principalities. Comparable to these were the Czech language public elementary schools authorized by the school law of 1869, as well as the French primary schools belatedly established by the Jules Ferry law of 1888. It took a defeat in the war with Germany in 1870-71 to persuade the French that they really ought to educate their young people, as the Germans and Czechs and Dutch and many of the Scandinavians were already doing. So the French moved to catch up as fast as they could. The British got around to doing this about 1902. Germany's catching up to them in iron, coal, and steel production was a real shock, and the British decided they'd best move to this type of education as well. I didn't mention the United States being first because in the states of the late and unlamented Confederacy, the slave owners didn't really care to educate very many people in a basic education. So this type of school doesn't happen until the end of the Civil War and federal reconstruction in the South. And this formal education and knowledge of agriculture and industrial technology, as I mentioned at the beginning, usually enabled, I'm just using Czech and German immigrants as an example for other immigrants, immigrants whose literacy and skills were comparable, to obtain jobs as skilled laborers in the U.S. or given sufficient capital to become self-employed farmers. And I make, too, in the paper the observation that most of you are familiar with, that neither the wealthiest nor the poorest Europeans typically immigrated to the Americas. Those most likely to depart were farmers who owned 6 to 10 hectares of land, an amount insufficient to support a family, but whose sale would pay for transportation to the New World, as well as provide some capital to invest in a farm or small business. Churches of all denominations, as well as synagogues representing different varieties of Judaism, were quickly established by the first settlers to arrive from other parts of the United States or directly from abroad, and often with financial support from American denominations or from national or non-conforming churches overseas. Interesting examples are German Methodism, founded here in the United States by Wilhelm Nast with support of Procter & Gamble money, German Congregationalism to win some of the Germans away from booze and Sabbath breaking by the Congregational Church, Czech Presbyterianism organized by Vincenz Písek in New York with support from Vanderbilt money, again to appeal especially to the unchurched Czechs. Well, maybe we can convert them to Protestantism. They seem hostile to Catholicism. This was an enterprise that had small success. I've written about it in Nebraska History if you're interested in an article on Czech Protestants, minority within a minority. Churches are very important to the immigrants. And they also, I think, most historians of immigration would agree, they facilitate acculturation because all religions espoused values that most Americans deem to be desirable imperatives for good citizenship and honest business practices. Jewish immigrants among, let's say, the Czech, the German, Italian group, among others, ordinarily associated more often with their own, with a larger Jewish community, rather than with the national group whose language they spoke as they grew up. And, of course, Jews as Protestants were divided, although not as in such a complicated way, into different denominations, notably Reformed, Orthodox, or Conservatives. Czech Freethinkers I've written about in Prairie Fire. I commend that to you. I could say lots more about railways, but I've run out of time, and I won't. And in conclusion, I would like to say a few words about the extent to which, in the case of the Italians, Germans, and Czechs, 20th century history may have accelerated acculturation. Mussolini was a thug, I think, surrounded by thugs. He had some support in Italian-American communities, but in others, notably in the predominantly Sicilian immigrant community in Omaha's Little Italy, he had very little. But fascism helped to give Italy a bad name among Americans and even among Italian immigrants. May have, to a degree, accelerated acculturation. Worse is Germany's predatory behavior in the first half of the 20th century, launching two world wars, cruelly exploiting the resources and the labor of people they conquered, and in the Second World War, engaging in mass murder on a horrendous scale. This has to have caused many German Americans and their descendants to be ever thankful their ancestors chose to cross the Atlantic and come here. And finally, the Czechs. Communism was very popular in Czechoslovakia. The Czechs and Slovaks imposed communism on themselves with the approval of the Soviet Union, but they did it themselves. They controlled the army, they controlled the police. And in the last free election, the communists had 40% of the Czech vote and 36% of the vote in entire Czechoslovakia. So this long period of communism gave Czechoslovakia a bad name, and as it did Yugoslavia, and is perhaps one, though not the main reason, why these two states didn't survive the fall of communism in the form that they had been so optimistically created after World War I. And today, we still note that the economic prosperity, ever more so, of what we call our Atlantic community and even the world, is dependent upon a world economy that makes our prosperity and argues for our continued involvement in world affairs as it does in our own local and state interests. I thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer questions.